right. Welcome to another edition of the Beer Opinions Podcast. Hi, I'm Pat Berger, owner of Kaiser Tiger and Patty Long's. And with me is Bruce White, owner of the Chicagoland Beer Tours. How are you?
Doing well. Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Kwanzaa, whatever it is you celebrate.
Yeah.
It is that time of year. And it's nice and cold here in Chicago. We're upstairs at Kaiser Tiger, and the curling court is being laid. There's ice in the backyard, and people are excited to get out there and throw some stones. It is, and drink some beers. It's that time of year.
It's a good time. I'm kind of like, you know, I feel like to survive a Chicago winter, you need to be in the right headspace. And this year, I'm pumped. I'm excited. I love snow, at least at the beginning. I'm ready for it.
Yeah, and you have to dress proper, right?
Yeah.
That's all it's about.
Yep.
Layers, proper coat, hat, scarf, gloves.
Yeah, you know. Long underwear, you know.
Sometimes.
Yeah, and there's beer.
And
beer always helps.
It does. So does whiskey. All right. We are honored to have the pleasure of having a return guest. This is the first return guest on the Beer Opinions Podcast. Local Chicago beer and bar legend, Michael Roper.
Hello.
Michael, how are you?
Good, good.
We are very happy to have you back. You told us you would come back, and you kept your word. You are fresh off of what looks on Facebook to be a very wonderful trip to Belgium.
Yeah, it was a great trip. I've been there quite a few times. This was one of the better experiences I've had. You know, it's really good.
Excellent. We are... let's just dive into it, because we're looking for an update on the state of Belgian beer, right? You know, I've been 3 or 4 times, and it's country near and dear to my heart. The beers are near and dear to my heart. But, you know, as we all know, their sales, which were massive here in the U.S. Throughout the late 90s, early 2000s, have sort of been displaced by this craft beer revolution that's going on here in the U.S. And I always use the example of Patty Long's, where when we opened, we had over half of our taps were Belgian, because that was craft beer at the time. You know, that was the best we could get. And now, you know, I think I'm down to 1 or 2.
Yeah, well,
usually one.
Imports in general are really, really down in the United States. You know, it's part of the sort of locavore culture. It's hard to make the case that, you know, if you're, you know, buying local foods and everything, and that you're going to carry beer from Europe or Asia. So they have struggled a little bit. And it's a little deceiving if you look at some of the, you know, the beverage industry press. It shows that imports are either, you know, flat or even actually rising a little bit. And that's because they take into account Corona.
Corona, absolutely.
Mexican lagers, yeah.
Yeah, they take into account some beers that, you know, yes, the sales of Modelo are really, really up. But, you know, the combination of brands like Modelo with the local craft beers have kind of left a lot of English, German, and Belgian beers in the dust. And even some of the, you know, the kind of big brands of Europe, we don't see that much of anymore. I mean, when was the last time you saw a Newcastle or a Bass line in a bar? Even things like Stella, which were kind of ubiquitous, are fading fast. Heineken lines, you don't see very much anymore. If they are having trouble, you can imagine what the specialty beers of Belgium, you know, their place is. It's in decline.
Right. Now, let me ask you, because, you know, when I got into beer, those were the three big countries that we looked to, was England, Germany, and Belgium. And I feel when people started to get interested in craft beer in the U.S., it really propped up the Belgian brewing industry. It was a bit in decline in the 80s.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. And their ability to import beer to the U.S. Kind of bolstered them for a long time, right?
It saved countless breweries. It actually saved styles I'm not sure that there would be Flemish sour ales if it wasn't for the American market. I'm not even sure whether any of the lambic producers would have survived.
Yeah.
Because the thing is with lambic beers is that they're really not very profitable. I mean, it just takes too long to make them. The process is, you know, kind of complicated. And they're not moneymakers.
Right. You can't sell them for $100 a bottle. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, they don't get champagne price.
Right. And
maybe maybe on the secondary market.
So the American market was what really saved them. And now they're kind of watching that go away. And some of the reason it's going away is because American brewers have done such a great job brewing styles that they thought were unique to them. You know, that they thought no one else can possibly make these beers. I mean, the Germans felt the same way about, you know, their lagers. They thought, you know, our lagers are different than your lagers. And, you know, we have the water, we have the expertise, we have this, you know, ancient beer culture. You're never going to catch up. But yeah, they did.
I feel like Germany sort of had the science down, but Belgium had this magic, right? That I think, you know, certainly myself in, you know, in the 90s, I didn't think was replicable. You know, I didn't think you could replicate it. And American brewers kind of unlocked those secrets.
Well, and, you know, they, to their credit, I mean, the Belgians were very welcoming to visiting American brewers. They took them into their brew houses. They showed them what they were doing. And sometimes they even lent them a little yeast. You know, they,
and if they didn't lend it, some people just stole it.
Yeah.
Get the old swab out. And
yeast is everywhere, including in the bottom of a bottle, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I know a lot of American craft brewers who are literally their house yeast. They cultivated from a dregs of a bottle.
Absolutely. Mm. And, you know, I just think that Americans went over there and learned a lot and brought that here and then did what Americans do. We found ways to, you know, to riff on it, you know, take, mm-hmm. you know, do some, you know, interesting new takes on these styles. But there are other breweries that actually tried to be extremely true to styles. I mean, if you have an Allagash triple, it's pretty good. I think that almost any Belgian brewmaster would say, wow. And
right.
You know, it's amazing.
But yeah, yeah, and then, you know, because they're American, Allagash went and took that triple, put it in a bourbon barrel, and you end up with something, you know, called Curio that is, to me, something, I mean, I would have never even thought of that in a million years. It's delicious.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable. And because, you know, I guess as Americans, we're not, we're not rooted in tradition in this stuff. So we think outside the box, and the Belgians are rooted in tradition.
Yeah. And I'd say the Germans are even more so.
Way more so. Right.
And,
yeah.
And it's turned into a ball and chain for them.
Yeah.
You know, like they would turn off their own audience if they, you know, didn't, you know, play to this ancient code. And unfortunately, that makes the beers less appealing to Americans.
And it's interesting. I can't say how many craft breweries that kind of specialized in Belgians, you read how the brewery started, and it almost is always the same, which is, I was on a bike trip through Belgium and I fell in love with these beers and wanted to brew them in the United States. And I just feel like that, if I went back, I mean, it's numerous breweries that have that kind of description and how they wanted to start their brewery.
I always say one of the, you know, the sort of the unknown, you know, starters of the American craft beer revolution was the Boeing 707. When it became economical for college students to travel to Europe, when it wasn't like, you know, a really, really expensive thing or having to get on a boat and, you know, take a week to get over there, when it became convenient to go, that exposed a whole generation of people in the 1960s and the 70s to these beers that were so different than ours, that were so much better. It was just, you know, it was like day and night. And it actually wasn't just beer. It was cheese. It was bread. It was, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, our food and beverage culture was very bland. And all of a sudden, millions of Americans were able to go. And it wasn't just the rich. It was like blue-collar people could save a little money and take a trip and then be exposed to these things and then come back to America. They came back to their home in America and were profoundly disappointed. And they also found out that, yes, I could go and buy bottles of German beer that was imported, but it's old, it's in a green bottle, and it doesn't taste like what I had in Munich, and it doesn't taste like what I had in Brussels.
Yeah, you discover that skunk flavor isn't supposed to be there. No. Well, no. I thought that was German beer flavor, you know? And then you go to Germany, you're like, oh, it's not there, and it's so much better.
Yeah.
When was your first trip to Belgium, Mike?
The early 90s, I went over and...
early days of Hopleaf, it was open?
Very early days. So I actually had not been there until after we opened in 92. But I went there shortly thereafter. And, you know, part of it was to go to breweries and check out that. But we actually had a couple of friends that lived in Belgium. And one of our friends' mother, she knew a couple of brewers. And so she drove us to these breweries. And then once we started going to breweries, that's pretty much all we did when we were there.
Well, what was... what was the beer scene like in Belgium at that point?
So, you know, there were, it was interesting. So the first brewery that we went to was Mortsebeet. Mm-hmm. And the owner of Mortsebeet had purchased a couple of small village breweries nearby that had closed. And we went there and they were dusty and they were closed and they weren't working. And he was just kind of mining them for equipment and stuff. I don't think he had any intention of actually reviving these breweries.
And did he own the cafe then in Brussels?
Is that, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
And he owned that first and then bought these?
No, he had there was a brewery that owned, you know, that's the Mortsebeet in Brussels was their Tide pub.
Okay.
And
great pub, by the way.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
So what was happening was that the little village breweries were closing all over the place. And there was a sort of a movement in the country of consolidation. And Tide pubs were being purchased by larger breweries who were kind of kicking out all the small village breweries' products. And, you know, like everywhere else in Europe, there was an aging population. People were drinking less.
And Tide houses are legal there.
Yes.
Unlike here. For those that don't know, Tide House is a pub that's owned by a brewery and therefore usually only serving that brewery's beer. Not always, but, you know, certainly pushing that brewery's beer.
Right. And in Belgium, you know, Americans went to Belgium expecting to go to pubs and find this vast selection of beer in every pub. Actually, it was extremely rare to find a pub that sold anything except one company's beer. And also, it was very rare to see a place that had more than one or two draft lines. You know, it was not what we expected. And draft beer...
It's a real bottle culture,
it's
right?
It's a very big bottle culture. The draft beer tended to be the local pilsner. And almost every brewery that made specialty beers also made a pilsner for the local market. And that beer was what actually paid all the bills. The specialty beers were something that a bunch of old people drank and were really not a cash cow at all until they found an export market. Because the local people just drank pilsners and lagers, and I have to say that Belgian pilsners and lagers were every bit as uninteresting as the pilsners and lagers in the United States. I mean, I never had at that time a lager beer in Belgium that was exceptional at all. They were pretty low alcohol, very, very lightly hopped, fizzy, often also in a green bottle, and really not that good. The other thing is that Belgium at that time had the same sort of draft line cleaning protocols as a lot of bars in the United States.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, and unfortunately the equipment was even older and draft beer was pretty scary. I have to say that draft beer in Europe today is not up to the standards of the United States. They still have a ways to go. Yes, there are some pubs that take really good care of their beer, but there are a lot more that don't.
Yeah, yeah, agreed. You know, that that was shocking to me. My first trip to Belgium, I think, was 93 or 94, and I had the pocket guide to Belgium,
oh, yeah,
you know, from Michael Jackson, and I was following that around, and my first stop was Antwerp, and I went to this beer bar. I can't remember the name of it.
Culminator?
Well, I ended up at Culminator, but the first one I went to was by the hostel I was staying in. It was in like the smaller square that where the church is, I guess. Anyway, it's a very small room, but it had a big outdoor space in front of the church. And I should have looked up the name before this podcast, but that would involve some sort of prep work on my
right,
part.
Yeah.
And then forget that. Anyway, they had 500 different beers, something crazy. And two drafts, and they were both lager. The drafts, I didn't have a draft, and then I did make my way to the Culminator, which of course is this very famous beer bar in Antwerp, and they were unusual for the fact that I think they had maybe six drafts,
right?
But the rest of their 1,000 bottle list was beer list was bottles. So very much, you know, I think Belgians had the opposite belief of Americans at that time, and maybe rightfully so. You know, it all depends on the situation and the beer, but they believed a bottle of beer, is better than a draft beer. And Americans have this idea that everything's better on draft. And I don't think either of those statements are true. You know, it really depends on the beer, on the style. The Belgians, I think the Belgian bottles do very well because they're very high carbonation, which doesn't work on draft very often, and they're bottle conditioned, so you
right.
get this nice natural soft carbonation that it's impossible to do on in a keg,
right? And they're living beers, you
right
know, that right. do a bottle is an ideal way of storing such a product. And draft just is only been a big thing in Belgium since a lot of American tourists are going on the beer tours.
Right, right. And they didn't even know how to put a lot of this beer in kegs until places like the Hop Leaf said, hey, we need drafts of this. This is what we sell here. And, you know, breweries like Duvel and Chimay, put their beer in a keg for the first time ever just in the last, 5 years, 6 years.
Right, and a lot of those beers are not available on draft in Belgium. They're
right.
only available
right.
as export. So the Belgians don't think of those beers as draft products. But, you know, one of the things that I have gotten out of the last few trips I've taken to Belgium is how much Belgium now is influenced by American brewers, American beer, American marketing, all these different things that they've, they never really thought too much about. they are thinking about now. And it is very hard to find a Belgian brewery owner or brewmaster who hasn't traveled extensively in the United States.
Yeah.
And they have visited breweries. And it's not like when they visited breweries in the late 80s, early 90s. Now they've come here with a great deal of respect for what's going on here. They drink the beers and they go, you know, wow, this is really good. And they've also met a lot of the key figures in American brewing, and they get along. You know, they're not feeling like these people are stealing from us or they're taking our market. They're saying they're doing a great job. What can we learn? And so it's sort of the opposite of what happened in the 80s and 90s when all these American brewers went to Belgium and to England and to Germany too, to learn and to pay homage to what was going on there. And now it's reversed. And also it's kind of a two-way street. People are going back and forth. They're starting to do collaborations.
Right.
And, you know, because you have a situation where, like, Mortgat purchased Boulevard, purchased Omegang and Firestone Walker.
Firestone Walker, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now there's this symbiotic relationship that is really fantastic.
I think the Belgians might own Anheuser-Busch, too.
Yes, they
that sale might not be going as well. Yeah. But
no, and I don't think that so far they've taken advantage of the collaborative opportunity.
No, not many collaborations have been made there. But yeah, that you know, it segues into my next question, which is new breweries in Belgium. I've heard that they are heavily influenced by what's going on over here.
Absolutely. One of the highlights of my trip was to go to the Brussels Beer Project.
Yeah.
So Brussels Beer Project is, you know, it's a storefront brewery that could be across the street from here in Chicago. I mean, it is totally designed from like the American almost nano brewery concept. So they, it's a neighborhood brewery. At this point, they don't think that they're going to be selling their bottles in Japan, you know, or anything like that. But they do actually have a very interesting growth model in mind. Is that they actually have an outpost in Paris now? That is a similar storefront,
like a
operation.
Tide House kind of a thing, or an actual brewery.
A brewery.
Oh.
They're not sending beer from, uh-huh. They're brewing there. And it is called Brussels Beer Project.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they see that this is going to be something that they're going to do around in other countries.
Almost kind of like Goose Island is doing with their brew pubs now around the world.
Yeah, except this is such a small scale thing.
Okay, yeah.
And one of the more interesting projects that they are doing at their brewery is that they have this program where they're making a bread beer. So they hire refugees to go at night to bakeries and restaurants and gather up bread that would otherwise be thrown in the dumpster. And they take this bread, and that becomes part of the grain bill of the beer.
Huh.
And why not?
Yeah. Yeah.
At this point, they only use white bread. So, you know, obviously there's these dark brick-like rye breads that they make there. That doesn't work.
Okay.
It's
almost like Egyptian beer, you know, like an ancient recipe.
They go around and they pick up, you know, van loads of, bread and it becomes a major part of the grain bill of a beer that they're brewing. and I tasted it, and it was good beer. It's
interesting, yeah.
Why not? I mean, and
Parisians don't buy day old bread.
No,
you know, they get their baguette on the way home, and if it wasn't made that day, they're not buying it.
So the thing is that they're doing something. They're you know, nobody likes to waste food. There are people.
Only so much bread pudding you can make, right?
Right, and croutons.
Yeah, and croutons.
And then there are some new immigrants in Brussels, in Paris, that need work. And here's an easy job. You're just, mm-hmm. you know, driving a van around, picking up bread. So it provides something for them that may be their foot in the door, their start of life in a new country.
Yeah, that's super cool.
And mm-hmm. And then they have this product that comes from this that's delicious, and people are drinking it, and well, seems like they're making a little profit. The pub itself is very low-key. It's not like fancy design or anything. Very relaxing. It was full of like neighborhood folks at long tables. It's a convivial atmosphere. They do a little bit of food. It looked like I said, it this seems so American. There's something about this, but that struck me as influenced by things that are going on in the United States. And
what other kind of beers are they making? Are they making American IPAs?
Yes, they are. And you're seeing that the European breweries in general feel that they have to.
Is it becoming as popular over there and sought after as it is here?
It is, but you know, an IPA there is not like our IPAs.
Yeah, I've really yet to have a good one in Europe yet.
I've had good ones, but I don't know that I would immediately identify them as IPAs because, you know, Europeans in general don't like the extreme bitter that we seem to be addicted to.
Yeah, people didn't like it here either. you know, I just feel like someone's got to have the balls to just do it, you know, just be like, hey, you know, most of my experiences are in Ireland with this. And, you know, I go to these breweries and taste it. And, you know, the brewmaster's saying, what do you think? Like, it's not hoppy enough. It's not bitter enough. It's not, you know, doesn't have as much oomph. Well, the Irish don't really like that. Well, they don't know it either. You know, someone's got to be that guy who says, I don't give a fuck what, you know. I don't want to appeal to everyone. I only want to appeal to people searching out this beer, you know? And I mean, it's a hard thing to do. But you know, it was the same story here 20 years ago. You know, when people like Three Floyds were making these crazy hoppy beers, you know, those guys at the Chicago Beer Society did not like those beers. You know, they were all from the old guard and going, oh, this is too hoppy. This is, you know, too bitter.
The Belgians all describe it as out of balance.
Right.
You know,
right.
If you talk to a brewmaster, in Belgium, they will always say, I don't understand why so many of your popular beers are so out of balance. And because they see, you know, the malt being pushed aside by, you know, you can't taste the malt because there's so much hop character in this beer.
Yeah, and sometimes that's true, you know.
It is.
You know, there is... You always need to strike a balance, right? But I think they are also hesitant to up the malt flavor to match a really hoppy beer because, you know, they also don't like to drink 7% beers yet. Not in Belgium, but this is the problem in Ireland, you know?
No, yeah. And in Belgium, they're still pretty accustomed to pretty high alcohol beers.
Yeah, they are.
And, you know, people are, you know, they're used to the Trappist ales, which, you know, the Trappist ales are the one category of beer that can be found all over the country, whereas, you know, you will not find Saison DuPont much in Antwerp or in Ghent or Brussels because it's from the far south and it's not their beer. Rodenbach has had a real hard time selling their beer outside of Rosselaer. You know, they've tried different things to market new products to other parts of Belgium, and they've all failed.
Belgium is actually kind of it's a bit segregated, right? It's got two different languages. There's kind of a hard border there, right?
It's no different than if you're in Italy and you're, as an American tourist, people go to Sicily and they ask for a bottle of Chianti, and people are like, nobody drinks Chianti here. Right. That's from Tuscany. Why would I drink that? Mm-hmm. And the Tuscans don't drink wine from Calabria because they don't know it. It's not theirs. The French, we think all the French, they all drink Burgundy. Well, not really. They drink Burgundy and Burgundy.
Yeah.
And so the Belgians are the same way about beer. The Germans are the same way. They're extreme, in many ways, the locavore movement that's becoming popular here has been the rule there for hundreds of years.
It's based on Europe, right? The whole locavore movement.
And that's what you get, too, when you have such a much longer, and you touched on this, Pat, much longer history with brewing. You're going to have your centuries of kind of, or if not longer, of kind of brewing traditions and drinking traditions, whereas here, I mean, we just don't have that at all. I mean, it's not even close, so that makes sense.
Yeah, our tradition is drinking two different beers, both made, one made in Milwaukee and one made in St. Louis.
Yeah, right. Taste pretty
much the same.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and I think that there's other things involved. A lot of the breweries in Europe and in Belgium in particular, the families that own these breweries are important pillars of their community. They're known, it's like Van Hanselbroek. They are a wealthy family that has been big landowners in their area for centuries, and they happen to own the brewery too. So everyone knows them and of them. Some members of their family are like in the European Parliament and things like that. So that kind of connection, it's happening here now, where we know in your neighborhood, the folks at the brewery on the corner, I see them in the pubs, I see them, at the grocery store, and they become part of this community that's larger than just making beer.
Yeah. I kind of wanted to backtrack just a little bit, just because there might be some people who aren't as familiar with Belgian styles of beer, and just kind of briefly touch on why Belgian beer is so, kind of a little description on the styles and why Belgian beer is so important and such a unique kind of, why they have such unique styles compared to the Germans and the English and other parts. So the lambic comes to mind for me is kind of a preeminent example of this.
Yeah, the lambic beers probably more than any other style. The process of making them is unchanged over the centuries. There are some very old German styles, but if you go and visit that brewery, it's the same stainless steel pipes and stuff that you see.
You see a monk sitting in front of a computer pointing and clicking. I'm serious at these Clouster breweries,
So, there's still like something very ancient and also very hands-on. On this last trip, I visited Bone Lambic, and Frank Bone had just done an event at the Hop Leaf the month before, so we had chatted quite a bit, and then, going to see him at the brewery with his sons, who are kind of in the process of taking over. They've done a lot of modernization there.
He's kind of one of the newer lambic producers, right?
He is, but he took over, the facility that he's using is an ancient lambic brewery.
Yeah.
He explained as we walked through the brewery how there are some things you can modernize about a lambic brewery, and then there are some things you can't. And so the cool ship that he is still using is very old. And he says, no matter what else we do, every drop that comes out of this brewery comes through that cool ship. and that cool ship is not changing. So we might, you know, the brew kettles, the old ones that had these wooden tops that came down, like it looks great in a museum, but it's hard
to brew with. Yeah.
And so they have a modern brew house that's attached to a little bit of this ancient technology. And that is, you know, it's a way of melding this old process with the new process. Now, Castile von Hanselbrück just built an enormous new brewery. I'm still rather boggled by the size of it because I don't know, do that many people drink Castile beer? So they make lambic there, the St. Louis lambics. And so this is a completely new brew house. It is about 10 miles from their old one. So it's not like they added on to an existing one. So, you know, of course, they're very worried about, you know, you start a new lambic brewery. How do you transfer the cultures that are in the room? So they built a new cool ship, but they took all of the wooden support beams from the old building and installed them. So the ceiling and the support beams are these, like, you know, 200-year-old chestnut beams that came from the old brew house. And they made sure that they didn't clean them or do anything. So they wanted to bring some of that culture into the new brew house. And they seem to feel that they have succeeded in doing it without changing too much of the...
Are they able to, like, check under a microscope to see if they have the same bugs going on?
They do check, and they have found that there is a continuity. Of course, the walls are new. There's some new stuff. So there are invaders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they have to welcome them.
And lambics are kind of unique because of that wild fermentation and just not really, especially back before you had the microscopes and could kind of check on this stuff.
The brewer is, there's stuff that he's not controlling.
Yeah. There's,
you have to embrace that, right?
Well, yeah. And I think a lot of it is because the method hasn't really changed. The method predates understanding fermentation in general.
Right.
I mean, you know, our actual understanding of fermentation is, it came with Louis Pasteur. I mean, it's
1800s, right?
Yeah, the late 1800s.
Yeah.
Prior to that, beer making, wine making was a happy accident that no one really understood.
It was magic.
God's will.
They knew how to make it happen again and again, but they didn't know how it happened. I mean, it's like, you know, Thomas Edison actually didn't understand anything about electricity. You know, he knew how to manipulate something that he didn't really understand. Well, the exact same process was the winemaker, the brewer of the 16th, 17th, 18th century. They were completely in the dark as to what was really happening until we had more sophisticated microscopes,
right,
and people were actually trying to learn about it. And when they did discover that, most other breweries completely changed the method that they made beer to manipulate the fermentation process to their ends, except lambic breweries, and you could say also the Flemish sour style,
right,
which, you know, those are the fooder beers that are, you know, if you go to American breweries, they're sticking a fooder here in the back of the brew house. They're all followers of Rodenbach, you know.
There isn't a big difference between a lot of those beers and lambics. I mean, those guys aren't pitching yeast a lot of the time.
Right, right. I think the common thing is letting nature take its course, do whatever, you know, like.
I mean, Rodenbach certainly isn't dumping bacteria into their beers. It's just there.
No, and, right. And you know, Rodenbach has the most fooders of any beer in the world. They have 199 fooders, and many of which are over 100 years old.
Wow. Right.
So, of course, they have to replace individual staves as some of the wood becomes soft, mushy, and leaky. But there are staves in those 100-year-old fooders that have been there for 100 years. And that means that they are from trees that were maybe several hundred years old when they were torn down 100 years ago. Right. So, you know, it's hard to reproduce that.
Mm-hmm. And fooders are huge, right?
Like, they are big.
I mean, I remember seeing photos from what's the brewery in Colorado?
New Belgium.
Who I believe uses at least some. And I couldn't believe the size.
They have 77 now.
Yeah, they have the most in the U.S., right?
Yeah. They call it the, Lauren Salazar calls it the fooder forest.
Forest, yeah.
I think they're individually named, as I recall.
She has names for all of them, and we just did an event at Hopleaf with her, and they named a fooder for us.
All right.
Hey,
all
right.
It's on a little brass plaque.
And they have a connection to Rodenbach, right? Didn't they hire someone from there?
Yeah, so the original brewer at New Belgium was from Rodenbach, and he still has a connection, although he's opening his own brewery now. So there was a tie, and so that's why they were the first brewery in the United States to have fooders. And now there's a company near St. Louis,
yeah.
I think, that's
making
fooders,
them,
and they can barely keep up with the demand.
They can't
keep
up. Everyone I know is on the wait list.
Huh.
Yeah. Off Color just bought a couple from, I think, from France, maybe. It'll be interesting to see what they come up with.
Yeah. Lambics and Flemish sours are you know, very unique to Belgium styles. And then there's the Saison, which... It's a style that is being reproduced very often, not just in the United States, but new breweries are brewing it in Belgium that never did before. And, you know, the thing is if you brew a Saison style, which is a farmhouse beer, and you're on the south side of Chicago, it's clearly, you know, you're not a farm, you know. You know, the original Saisons, like DuPont, they're located on a working farm. And up until the late 80s, DuPont grew their barley. They grew their wheat. They actually malted their own grains. Their malt house burned down in, I think, 88 or something. And at that point, they started buying malt from other places, and at that point, in some ways, became less of a true farmhouse brewery. But it is still located on a working farm. What I like is that when you talk to them, if you ask them what are you, they're going to say, I'm a farmer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They see that true connection to an agricultural product that we've kind of lost.
Yeah, it's that DIY spirit where,
yes.
You know, you're talking off before we started, before we hit record, we were talking about the Unibrew brewmaster coming to the Hopleaf, and you told me he's a farmer.
Yes, Jerry is a farmer.
Montreal, right?
Outside of Chamblay, and Chamblay is in a rural area, and he raises goats and chickens and hogs, and he says, I don't buy soap, I make my own soap, and by saving rendered fat.
He
slaughters his animals and butchers them himself, and he's a brewer.
Clearly never sleeps.
Because he's got a family too, and he says, we live in the middle of nowhere, so we homeschool our kids, and I don't have time to. I mean, like to put my shoes away. You know?
I know. Yeah, I was telling you, I can't keep up with my kids' laundry, much less their schooling. You know,
For saisons, my understanding is originally it's a French word for season,
yes.
And that's where the farmhouse it was kind of made for seasonal for the harvest. I also had heard that originally it was kind of a lower alcohol beer so that it was safe to drink and kind of was for more hydration purposes, even compared to, you know, the alcoholic ones.
Oh, they were used as something that was refreshing and nutritious for the people that were working in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sometimes the farms also used it as a barter item. You know, like if you were a hog farmer and maybe your neighbor has chickens and you want some eggs, so you give them a few bottles of your beer as a barter item. But I think it was mostly that farm labor was very labor intensive. You needed a lot of people. And so, you know, you fed them. And you may offer them a place to stay while you're doing the harvest, and you need something to drink. And beer was the, that was what people that worked hard drank, not just because it was refreshing, but also because it provided a lot of calories that people needed who did that kind of really, really hard work. And the Saison style is something that actually... is not strictly Belgian because the area of northern France, just to south of the Belgian border, they brewed beers just like that too. They were, you know, just the beers that farmers made in their kitchen. And it was a style that was primarily made by women who farm wives. They made this as a kitchen beer.
And it was a very broad style.
Yeah.
You know, it literally meant it was made on a farm. And, you know, we use Saison DuPont as this benchmark of the style, but that's because most of these farms stopped making beer, and right. We don't know what they were making, mm-hmm. But chances are, no, you know, none of them tasted alike.
And I think that the other commonality between the Saisons is that the yeast that they use is not like a super cultivated yeast. It's not a wild yeast. It's not something that's just in the air, but it is not a super cultivated yeast either. So it's a little bit, the real Saisons have a little bit of funk in them,
mm-hmm.
But not.
You know, chances are they originated on the farm and then they just kept repitching and using the same. And, you know, they vary very greatly and some don't work that well and, you know, some work at higher temperatures, and you know it's a very very broad style that you know the American you know beer nerd culture has to you know tie down styles. You know, we just have to wrap our minds around it. I don't think the Belgians do that as much. Maybe they do more now, but certainly my first trip to Belgium wasn't it. You know, you didn't ask for a style of beer. You might have asked for a region or you know. A strength or something like that, but they weren't thinking stylistically. They were thinking more of, you know, I don't know. What do you think they were thinking, Michael? You know more than I do.
Well, you know, and I think the greatest example is Trappist beers. You know, like,
yeah.
You know, like, what is the commonality between Rochefort and Orval? There's no commonality,
right?
And yet, you know, people say. Trappist style or Abbey style, and it doesn't really tell me that much. And I think that people just in Belgium don't think that things have to be categorized as much as we do.
We even try to put them as like single, doubles, triples, you know, quads. That was just really an alcohol categorization for these guys. It wasn't a style.
No. You know? And you know, I mean, I think that it's the same kind of thing that Americans have tried to do with like French wine, we want the grape to be on the label, mm-hmm. you know. Whereas the French figure, well, it's Burgundy, it's red, it's Pinot Noir, you know. but you don't have to put Pinot Noir anywhere on the label. But Americans, they'll sell a lot more of it if you put Pinot Noir on the label.
You have to put it in the Pinot Noir section. Otherwise, we won't know. Yeah.
Right. And so we want definitions.
Right.
And I don't think Europeans in general wanted that. Until recently, they do. And why do they? Because they want to protect these mm-hmm. unique things,
yeah.
which is why the Trappists decided they had to have a logo, and they have a consortium, and they don't want like some big conglomerate making a beer and putting pictures of monks on it
mm-hmm.
and calling it an Abbey beer. You can be an Abbey-style beer. Of course, the Czechs have tried to do that with Pilsner, and there's just no way.
yeah.
Cat's out of the bag on that one, yeah.
But I mean, the Belgians are trying it with even just the word Belgium.
Yes.
They're trying it with...
UNESCO, aren't they, trying to do, like, a heritage...
Well, the yeah. heritage...
They've sued people like Blue Moon
yep.
To try to get the Belgian word off the label.
Wow.
And they've had, you know, some of, like... So Champagne has actually been pretty successful.
Yeah.
And...
bourbon has been very successful. You know, there's a lot of alcoholic beverages that have figured it out, and cheeses.
Cheeses, you know, you can't, like, in the EU, you can't sell feta that is not made in Greece, and it is not half goat and half sheep's milk cheese. So in the United States, we sell cow's milk feta. That's not feta. The Greeks would love it if they could stop us from calling that feta.
Mm-hmm.
So now there is more attention to, what you're actually going to call a beer style. Whereas I don't think 50 years ago, I really don't think people cared much. I think the most important thing 50 years ago for a Belgian beer or a German beer was, what town did it come from? And, you know, what place was more important than recipe? Place and family name was more important than style. But now I think, our influence never stops. Now the style is becoming more important.
Well, in globalization, we live in a globalized world, so it's hard to, which is also our influence, I suppose. Yeah.
Did you see any American craft beer over there?
American craft beer, Sierra Nevada, Brooklyn, Stone, Lagunitas, a few other ones, Anchor.
Is Goose over there?
Yes, Goose is over there. In Europe. I have not seen these beers in Belgium.
Really? Hmm. None of them in Belgium?
Huh? You don't even see German beer in Belgium.
That's true. You also don't see Belgian beer in Germany.
No. but you do see American beer in Germany.
You do,
I was in Berlin a year ago, and I saw some American beer, but I did not see much of other European beers there. However... You know, the big growth market for beer from everywhere are those countries that had a historically weaker beer culture. So if you go to Carrefour, the gigantic sort of the Walmart of France, their beer aisle has a lot of American beer. It has a lot of Belgian beer. Mm. It has beer from all over the place. Spain and Italy are huge export markets for Belgian brewers. Several of the breweries that I visited said that, you know, our number one export market is France. Our number two is either Italy or Spain, and then America.
Wow.
So they're selling a lot of beer, and especially through the big sort of cross-national supermarket chains like Carrefour. They have pretty impressive beer aisles now.
Yeah, the Netherlands have always had some of the best Belgian beer bars in the world.
Yeah, really, you know, great.
They love Belgian beer there.
But you do see, you know, like Sierra Nevada now is starting to become a draft product in Europe. But I have not seen it in Belgium yet. And I'm not sure that they're that interested in it. And I don't know, there also might be, you know, just like we have archaic distribution laws and things, those things might exist in Belgium, and they could be protectionist. So while it's very hard for any country in the EU to be protectionist against other EU countries, they really can't. They can prevent American products. They can prevent Japanese products, food products and beverages from getting into their market because they're not part of the union.
And pay-to-play tends to be legal in most European countries as well. So you literally can sign a contract with a brewery and say that handle belongs to you.
Yes.
You pay me for it, whatever, you know, all that
if
stuff is legal
houses,
there.
Yeah. Yep.
So for an American craft brewer to get in who isn't used to paying for tap handles and probably isn't going to, it gets tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know that, you know, in the near future whether there's going to be a big interest in American beer in Belgium. I think the Belgians still feel, if you had some Belgian people at the table here and you asked them who makes the best beer in the world, they're all going to say the Belgians do. And they do think that there's something uniquely special about their beer culture. And so I don't know that there is as much interest in it as in France or in Italy or Spain.
Certainly, England is all about American craft beer now, right?
Yeah, and the change that's bringing about in England is really interesting because, of course, the Americans aren't sending real ale there, and
right.
So there is a new acceptance to draft, like American style draft beer, just pushed with CO2, that used to be thought of very negatively by the beer connoisseurs of England. And
yeah, I think Cambra is a whole nother podcast.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's a can of worms.
It really is.
And
yeah.
Those people are,
they're very English.
Yeah. And they're, you know, they're like the ISIS of beer, you know.
You said it, not me. Oh, that is another podcast. We're gonna have to schedule that one.
I mean, you know, they're so pure. You know, there's right and there's wrong and there's no
there's no in between.
Middle ground.
Yeah.
But I think that they are, and actually, I know for a fact that there are younger people that are joining their organization who say, you know, I kind of like that beer, and maybe we should not just rule it as it's all bad. Because it isn't all bad.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they had to do that at the beginning because they literally saved cask beer.
They did.
For the world, and it took that attitude to do it. But now, obviously, like I said, that's a whole nother podcast, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm.
But you know, it is. But it, you know, the thing is that you know, American beer comes to Europe like American beer comes to us here. So, you know, the type of kegs that we use, how we, you know, how much CO2 we put in the keg is a little different than there. And they have different kinds of faucets than we do.
They do, yeah.
I think that in Belgium, like in much of Europe, the thing that they really need to get as part of their draft beer culture is they need to start refrigerating the kegs. You know, a lot of pubs store their backup kegs at room temperature or even worse.
So I've seen them pour beer at room temperature.
Yeah.
Where literally the only chilling you're getting is through the line.
They have these those electric chillers that, you know, so the beer is stored warm and then basically it's like a jockey box.
Yeah, it cools itself through the line.
And you know, this is unpasteurized product. It does not lend itself to sitting for however many days or weeks warm. And I think it's the reason why draft beer is often still pretty awful in a lot of Europe.
Still pretty awful in a lot of the U.S. too. I sent a beer back on Saturday night. I haven't done it in a long time, but it was god awful.
Yeah, the bars that I go to tend, you know, I just
I was at a music venue, so okay. You got to do what you got to do, you know.
Yeah, plastic cups.
Yep,
dirty lines.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the better ones, but. I'm not going to say who it was. No. I like them a lot. You know, and then I switched to Sierra bottles. Tasted great.
Always a good move.
Always a good, yeah. Well, you know, I could talk to you all day long, Michael. You know that. This is just, you know, gleaming nuggets of knowledge from you is always a pleasure. But we are running out of time. Can you give us a quick synopsis on the state of Belgian beer in Belgium, and you know, is it good, bad, the same, different? What do you think?
I think that there are storm clouds over the Belgian beer industry, and if you're thinking about the culture in Belgium, I think that the problem that I see is that they are. Many, many breweries are selling very little of their beer in their home country. Some breweries that I visited said that they are selling over 80% of the beer they make is being sold as export to China, to Japan, to the United States, to France, wherever. I think that that's troubling in the long run. If you're, you know, this is a cultural product of a specific people and place. And if those people aren't drinking this beer, what happens a generation or two down the line? And so I find that a little bit troubling. There needs to be some sort of revival within their own
within
country.
The youth, right?
Yeah, young people, like, they need to be introduced to this. And I, at some level, they are doing it. I mean, I've been to a couple of breweries, and there are, like, grade school school trips to the brewery. And
yeah,
they take
that's
them,
neat.
They take them through a brewery, and they taste beer. You know, these are, I'm talking about, you know, fourth graders.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it.
And
try pulling that off in the U.S.
It's not going to happen.
Oh, that would not go well.
But you know, if you want to make a synopsis, I think that that's the number one thing that worries me. On the other hand, there are things like a Brussels Beer Project, which may, American-style ideas about brewing may save Belgian beer.
It's kind of encouraging that, I mean, you know, there weren't breweries opening up in Belgium 20, 30 years ago. There were breweries being saved, but not really new breweries opening. I mean, that's got to be a nice thing that there's, like, you know, brand new breweries opening.
There are brand new breweries. I will say that there's also almost every brewery that I've visited the last four or five times that I've been there are in expansion modes. And the expansion modes are caused by their need to make more beer to export, not for the domestic. So this trip I did go to St. Bernardus, which is in the midst of a pretty big expansion.
They have a great Christmas.
It's fabulous beer. Nice people. Yeah, so they good. I didn't know they grew their own hops, too. They have a huge hop
really?
Farm.
Oh.
Yeah, a huge hop farm, which was right at harvest when I was there.
Cool.
So we walked through the fields, and
neat.
it was just fantastic. You know, von Hansebrück, as I mentioned before.
What kind of hops do they grow?
Hallertauer is one of them. They're not brewing much. You know, some are actually brewing American styles, but a lot of them are using.
Because they use a lot of German and English hops in Belgium, right?
Yep, they do. So you know, Saint-Foulien just did a pretty big expansion.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things that happens with those expansions is that the breweries start to all look like the same.
The modern.
They're modern. Mm-hmm. They're very hygienic. They're very, you know, it's lots of stainless steel pipes. And so I feel like there's a certain romance that is lost. These breweries, when they do that, they tend to keep the old equipment, the old brew house, as a museum.
Right.
And you can see it. And realistically, when you look at that equipment, you go, I can see why no one misses it. The brewmasters go, God, I walk back in that room and I have nightmares.
You know? Breakout knives.
They have, PTSD from walking into their old brew house because it's so awful. But, you know, we as tourists, we want to see that old thing. If we go to a brewery there, you go to Orval even, and like the inside of their brew house looks exactly like the Sierra Nevada brew house in Chico or the Goose Island brewery on Fulton.
Yeah.
There is a sameness. It's the same bottling equipment. It's the same kettles that everyone uses everywhere. And so we are hoping to see this, you know, ancient thing that's going away. But I think it's inevitable that they have to modernize these breweries. And also the 19th century equipment is just wearing out. There's,
right.
You can only clean them so many times. You can only try to make spare parts for them so many times. So the Belgian beer industry in the next 10 years is going to look very different. It's going to look more modern. The recipes will be the same. There will be some new breweries that are going to be brewing more international styles. They will be continuing to look elsewhere to sell their beer. And China is it's a huge market for them.
It's the biggest market in the world.
And they see that as, so when at two or three breweries I went to, I asked, so you've seen declines in the United States, but how's your overall sales? They said, our sales were up, 12% last year, or our sales were up 7% last year, and it's all because we're exporting to Asia. We sell less beer in the United States, but more beer in Asia.
So they're finding their new United States, basically.
Yes, that's their new United States. Nobody seems to have figured out a way to sell a lot more beer in Belgium. and there are a few breweries that I have visited that actually do sell the majority of their beer in Belgium, but those are not typical. And there's all kinds of reasons. The demographics of Europe are changing. A lot of the youth in Europe come from places that do not have a drinking culture. Belgium is extraordinarily strict about drunk driving and has changed the way people drink there. I mean, in the United States, we talk about 08. It's not 08, 06, 04. If you have alcohol in your system, you are not supposed to drive a car.
Huh.
And the punishment for it is often impounding your car. I mean, just take your car away.
Yeah.
And take your license away for the rest of your life.
Wow.
It's the same thing that killed the Royal Pub in Ireland.
Yeah.
There's no way to get to it.
There's no way to get to it. So it has changed drinking culture there. It's not a bad, I mean, certainly I'm not an advocate of driving drunk.
None of us are. None of us are.
Yeah.
Of course.
People do drink differently now. You know, one of the things that, not just in Belgium, but in Europe in general, non-alcoholic beers.
I talked to somebody from Anheuser-Busch who said that they were ramping up their low alcohol or non-alcoholic beers because of the sales in Europe.
Yeah.
And I was like, that hasn't happened yet in the US, right? And they're like, no, not yet, but we think it's coming.
Even in Belgium, there are, I mean, non-alcoholic beers are actually one, they're getting more popular, and two, they're getting better. They actually, there are non-alcoholic beers that actually taste like beer.
That's shocking. Shocking to me.
I don't know how I feel about this. I feel a little, odd.
I'm not, you know, I'm not really interested in them, but I think that a, you know, a thoughtful alternative to alcoholic beers should be available to those people that either can't or want to drink less, whatever. If you can figure out a way to make it taste like beer, you know, it's not such a bad thing. I mean, I think it, you know, alcohol obviously adds a certain convivial, you know, thing that I like, obviously. But
I think it's better than gluten-free beer.
Yes.
We can all agree on that, right?
I think so. So that's what I think. I think you're going to see there are a lot of changes. There are some things staying the same. There are some family brewers that are selling. You know, I was very disappointed that Busteels.
Yeah, you had a very tight relationship with them, right?
Yeah, I'm very saddened by it.
They were bought by the mega
evil empire,
Anheuser-Busch, InBev.
Yeah. I mean, it's a generational change.
Other than that, they don't seem to be going through what we're going through with, you know, I mean, obviously the Giants are looking for breweries that are, you know, who can't keep up with demand. And, I mean, although you're saying that a lot of them are expanding, I don't see them going after these Belgian breweries like they are, you know, the American craft brewers just yet. But they kind of already did, right? I mean, they've been buying Belgian breweries for decades.
Well, and then there's the wild card there is that Mortgat has bought a lot of breweries there.
Yeah. But
no one thinks badly of a brewery that sells to Mortgat because they're still family-owned, they're still independent, and they don't make any bad beer.
And that's true. They're relatively small compared to Anheuser-Busch, but
everybody is.
You know, but InBev certainly went through and left a lot of destruction in their wake in the 90s. I mean, you know, when they bought Leffe and Hoegaarden and, a couple others, right? So Stella Artois, I guess. And so, I don't know, maybe they're done wreaking havoc in Belgium. Probably not, though. They're just biding their time.
Well,
right?
Jack Van Antwerp, who's worked for Busteels for many, many years, he actually, you know, was in he went into a big era of depression right after the sales. I talked to him in October, and he says, you know, I feel a lot better about this sale than I did then. And he says that I think that there are people at InBev now that actually understand what they're buying, and that taking something like Busteels, that was a seven-generation brewery, and changing it would be a huge mistake.
They are doing a better job with it, right? I mean, when they bought Hoegaarden, they decimated that beer.
Yeah.
Leffe, same thing. You know, it doesn't taste anything like it used to. Yeah. They do seem to understand that these things have value and should not be messed with too much.
So we'll see. Maybe they will actually succeed in, taking this brand and just, you know, keeping it alive. I think in the case of Busteels, the reason for the sale is a little complicated. I think that they expanded and they spent a lot of money. They borrowed the money from investment conglomerates, and it didn't pay off fast enough for them, and they got a little over their head, and they needed a white knight.
It was a little bit of a hostile takeover in the sense that there were some family members opposed and some for it, right?
I think the father's generation, he had no desire to make this sale, but he has a bean counter son there's some things about that sale that are that rubbed me the wrong way, in that the son who sold the brewery told me, well, my kids aren't interested in it. So I think that selling it now, you know, financially will set them for their, you know, for life and their kids for life. Well, his kids are daughters. They're still very young. They're not interested in it in his mind because women shouldn't be interested in this kind of business.
Yeah.
It just rubbed me the wrong way. I think he doesn't think his daughters are capable. This is a 7-generation company that's always been run by the sons. He didn't have any sons. And it just doesn't occur to him that the daughter
could take it over.
Could take it over. So I'd better sell it now when I have this great offer.
Yeah. Wow. That's terrible. Yeah.
That was my take on it. Maybe I'm wrong, but I just got this when I talked to them. I just got that feeling that there was something a little, you know, unpleasant about it.
Well, Michael, it has been an absolute pleasure, as always. So happy to have you back. Now it is shameless plug time. Tell us what's going on at the Hop Leaf. What's you guys got holiday things happening?
Well, you know, we, true to form, we are open 365 days a year. So we are actually
open Christmas.
We are open on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
You know, it's certainly not the biggest day of the year, but sometimes some people have spent way too much time with their family and they need to escape. And we are always happy to provide that.
I'm making a mental note right now.
Yeah, so am I. I'm actually going to be in Chicago for the first time.
Yeah. So we do stay open. We're in the midst of our 25th anniversary year still. So it started February 15th, and it will run through February 15th, and then we wait for the 50th anniversary in the future. We do have an event coming up with La Trappe. It's a charity program that they have called Pour It Forward. And we're doing something for Autism Speaks. And that is next week, the 22nd. So we're going to have some special La Trappe beers on tap. The sales of those beers will 100% go to Autism Speaks. And we are going to have some really cool sort of silent auction items and try to raise some money for a good cause. One of the cool things about the Trappists in general is that, you know, they live a very humble lifestyle, and the money that they make from selling beer goes to cool stuff. I mean, they have schools and clinics and water projects in Africa.
Yeah, I was going to say a lot of African charity work they do.
I think, you know, they're in Rwanda and Uganda primarily. You know, the Belgian monasteries have to make up for the bad things that Belgium did when they were colonial masters there.
Yeah. English got nothing on the Belgians.
No, the Belgians were not good colonial powers. So, yeah, we're, you know, check out hopleaf.com, and, you know, we can, we have events all the time.
Yeah. Always a fabulous place for lunch, dinner, and drinking.
I was in one of the greatest things that's happened to me, my buddy, and I don't mean to blow smoke, but my buddy moved about a two minute walk away from the Hop Leaf. So I was just there a couple weeks ago, and it's just such a fantastic place. So thank you.
Thank you.
And,
thank you.
I
more people to move in near us.
Yeah. So shout out to Justin and Jory. They're big fans as well. So,
sweet. Things what do you got good. Going on, Bruce?
Now we're touring. You know, beer jackets, we'll throw them on and tour through the winter, no problem.
I'm sure a beer tour makes a wonderful holiday Christmas gift.
And I thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yes, gift certificates for sale. They never expire. And you can purchase them right online at www.chicagobeerexperience.com. And they can redeem them for a date they choose.
Awesome.
How about you?
Kaiser's in full swing, holiday swing here. The curling courts are going to be open this weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah, so everyone get their curl on. Patty Long's is gonna, we're gonna do our big annual Goose Island BCS event January 19th, and I'm opening the cellar for it, and I will have bottles available all the way back to 2009.
Wow.
So yeah, should be a good one.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, so that's about it for us. I think we went a little over time, but how can you not when you have Michael Roper in the house? Thank you, Michael,
can't
for
shut
coming.
Me up.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Don't want to. Yeah. All right. Thanks to everyone for listening, and tell your friends, beeropinions.com.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.